Good afternoon. Welcome to people, you know, because we're running everywhere.
Like a dog.
So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere tractor and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And if you want to get a hold of them on the phone, it's 226-9226. And
so what if I just got a note that said PG&E says they might shut off the power in several areas,
to be determined. When's that happening?
Of the North State on Wednesday and Thursday of this week.
Well, you know, Pape Machinery could help you out with that because they have a full line of Honda generators
right now
in stock and ready to go. So go in and see them, and they can get you fixed up. So,
and you should do that before the power gets shut off.
Yeah.
Actually, just a hot tip there.
That way you won't need no stinking power. You could just hit your generator switch and just...
Keep all your food in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Don't have to make 900 pounds of jerky because you don't have a refrigerator anymore.
Yeah.
Heck with that.
Wrong.
Yeah, Pape Machinery.
Yeah, so anyway, we don't have any more detailed information than that about the PG&E thing, but if we do, we'll let you know. Today is November 17th, 2019, and sometimes I know we... Oh, Ashley, this just in. Do we have that for... We don't have a sound file on that, but that would be good.
Yeah.
PG&E says they are monitoring a potentially strong offshore wind event.
Oh, it's a wind event.
It's a wind event.
Huh.
Without the clowns,
get your
the balloons,
chairs.
The circus tent,
yeah.
None of that. It's not that kind of an event. Strong wind gust in excess of 50 miles per hour. Wow.
Yeah, with no rain in sight.
Yes.
Guess what?
And we've discussed this.
Yes,
that
watch
maybe
for
if
smoke.
We didn't spend $2.5 billion on green decalanser at this point because...
We haven't spent enough money to analyze it.
We are now in the throes of it. So we have done programs regarding this. We just did one. I don't have it up on my screen at the moment. But we spoke with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry, about this, I'm going to say 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I will...
it was November 3rd.
Was it?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Uh-huh. I have a photographic memory. Blackouts in the National...
Are you still using Polaroid, or have you moved to digital? For your photographs, I mean.
Analog.
Still having it developed at Crown Camera across the street?
Yeah, that's it.
Good one. That's all the fun we'll say I have about the power outage, because it's really not fun. So we have to have our fun now really quick before everybody gets angry.
It's amazing how dependent we are on electricity. You don't realize it until you don't have it. And then all of a sudden, life gets hard.
Yeah, kind of fascinating. Dr. Pry's been pushing that for years, and everybody kind of goes, eh, it's not a big emergency. Well, welcome to California, where it kind of is a big emergency. So just in case you have not joined us before... there is always a little customary screwing around at the beginning of the show. That being said, our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He also served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. So he's mostly, you know, just been hanging out.
Yeah.
In Washington, D.C., doing everything. So he has
he's the go-to guy.
He sent us a list of possible topics for future shows if we wanted to do something other than EMP. And I'm like, I don't really know what any of those things are. We could do all those. All those things would be awesome. So today's program is going to kind of focus on two of the topics he had on his list. One was our vanishing republic. Is the impeachment inquiry the end of our constitutional republic? Kind of timely, so we thought maybe we should go down that road. And then the other one is Turkey, the Kurds, and the future of NATO. And all of that, we hear a lot about all of this on the news, but the problem is the news doesn't teach us anything for the most part, talks about it in two-minute increments, and they all say the same darn thing. So our goal is to kind of bring you the rest of the story, I guess, to hijack a phrase from Paul Harvey. Because if we're a little bit smarter about this, we're going to know what we're looking at. And I'll, if you'd like the rest of Dr. Pry's information, we have that all posted at wethepeopleradio.us, and an archive of the show will be posted afterward. You can listen; doesn't cost you anything. And got other shows on there for you by the same guest. So there you have it. That is all my part. I'm totally done.
That was a lot.
Look at that.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Pry. Sky's the limit for you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being on. We appreciate it. Ton of information. I'm really curious about your take on NATO. We're starting to hear rumbles that...
Or we can start with the impeachment thing.
I don't know. Yeah.
It's all tangled up together, really. They've made this all sort of a conglomeration of stuff.
Sure. Well, your call. People may be more interested in the impeachment inquiry since that's going on every day. And intelligent people who are well read in the constitutional history of our republic, that may be obvious to them, but unfortunately, most Americans aren't familiar with their own history, and our schools don't teach our history anymore. And in the article you cited, Our Vanishing Republic, the fact of the matter is, I think a serious case can be made that as of the moment back in September when Nancy Pelosi announced the so-called impeachment inquiry, we really ceased to be a constitutional republic, because a constitutional republic requires everybody, including the two major political parties, to respect the Constitution. That's what makes you a constitutional republic. And if everybody doesn't play by the game, you know, whether it's the executive branch or the courts or in the Congress, one of the major two political parties, and it's the Democrats now, if they don't respect the Constitution and play by the rules and obey the law, then you don't have a constitutional republic. I think what we're in the middle of is basically a cold civil war to determine whether this country will come out of it on the other side as a constitutional republic or not.
Well, that's...
Even if they won't... That's, yes. Well, I didn't mean to talk over you.
No,
but
go ahead.
Those are the stakes. Those are how high the stakes are. You know, people have gotten so used to the Washington scandals over the ridiculous Mueller investigation and the absurd allegations that President Trump was a candidate of Russia, that I think that they are kind of fatigued, you know, with the notion of political scandal and sort of wave it away. But that's the bottom line of where we are. You know, our constitutional republic is not just at risk. It ceased to be while this illegal impeachment inquiry goes on. And, you know, if they succeed in changing presidents, I don't think that they will succeed in changing presidents by impeachment, but it could damage President Trump enough, which is what their goal is, so that they can win politically in the next elections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if that happens, I don't think we can have confidence in the future that future elections will be fair and balanced or legitimate, because the party that will have succeeded in displacing President Trump by foul means, by what is essentially an unconstitutional and illegal impeachment, you know, will not hesitate to use that tool or whatever other instruments are necessary, including weaponizing the intelligence community and the Justice Department, you know, to make sure that they have political power. You know, I mean, that's what the Democrats are showing us, that they've become a totalitarian movement. I mean, that's what a totalitarian movement is. It's a movement that doesn't care about the law, doesn't care about constitutions. It does whatever it takes to get political power. So those are the stakes that we're in. Those are the stakes.
Well, when you mentioned the intelligence community, I think we've all kind of realized that if you don't get control of the intelligence community, that's a big tool for somebody to use to oust somebody they don't like, not necessarily just the president, pretty much anybody. If our intelligence community is going to work against us, against the American people, that is That's a dangerous place to go.
And when they work against a president who has been elected by the American people, and no one in the intelligence community has been elected by the American people.
Exactly.
Okay? See, and that's really...
All right, they're all part of the permanent bureaucracy that the founders were worried about, you know, when they were debating the Constitution and putting in checks and balances. Their greatest fear, you know, was that the government itself, the administrative state, would undermine our constitutional republic and usurp the power of our elected political leaders. And this has been happening, you know, in part because of the fault of Congress over many decades, you know, allowing an administrative state to grow up that through the regulatory process basically becomes lawmakers. And but now, with the politicization, the radical ideologies, leftist big government ideologies that are so prevalent in the U.S. government, to the point that they think that somebody like a President Trump is illegitimate, somebody who wants to come in and do things differently.
Yeah, how dare he?
Right, exactly.
Dr. You know, Pryor, we have to take a really quick...
Are we not where the founders were afraid we would arrive?
Oh,
you know, when basically the conflict is not just between political parties anymore, but it's between a political party that believes in big government, basically is the embodiment of big government, is allied with...
When we come back after this break, I do want to talk about the bureaucracy in the sense that I think what we're seeing now is like a sales pitch. Everything is about the, a career foreign service agent. We couldn't possibly replace them. How mean is that? I mean, all this is, it's like a weird human resources discussion.
People have to realize they don't make foreign policy.
There's that, too.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
I see the red moon horizon. I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today.
Especially if this continues. So, Dr. Pry, I think the one thing that really no one in the media is really tackling is that all these people work at the pleasure of the president because we elected the president. We didn't elect them. And somehow it's being made to look like these people set the policy and how dare we make changes. So you've been staffed for a number of different things. I mean, I'm sure you've actually done more than we read in your bio at the beginning. So as a person who's been on the staff side of these things, I mean, where does your influence start and where does it stop, legitimately?
Well, legitimately on the Constitution, I mean, you're absolutely right that, you know, the president sets foreign policy. You know, that's his prerogative and that's his power and that's his responsibility. That's what he's supposed to do. All the rest of the executive branch, including the Department of Defense, the Department of State, they are to support the president's policies, to advise the president.
Whether they like them or not.
Yeah, that's right. But President Trump, unfortunately, bears some responsibility, too. I complain about this almost every day to friends, and they, you know, they agree
with
me, of course, because it's obvious. You know, because you know, the president, when he first came in, you know, he did not accept resignations that were tendered from the Obama administration.
Mm.
He didn't accept them, and he ended up appointing, also bringing into his administration many people who were basically never Trumpers or worked for people who were never Trumpers, and who did not support his election. And I think this was an example of someone learning on the job to be president, because he didn't understand that, you know, the staff, the people who come aboard, and the people who are there from the prior administration, are not truly professionals in the sense of the word the professional is used in the business community. You know, in the business community, a lawyer, for example, is a professional. And if you pay the lawyer enough money, he will argue, he will support your case in court or do what you want in terms of running your corporation. And if somebody else pays him money, he'll do the same thing and go in and do opposite policies and the rest. That's what a professional is in the business world. You know, what matters is money. And the people will use their talents to do whatever the boss wants. That's not that paradigm doesn't work in government, because most people who are in government, or at least the levels we're talking about, like ambassadorial levels and assistant secretaries of state and deputy assistant secretaries of state and the like, they're ideological. They're not doing it for the money. In fact, they can make more money in the private sector, and usually do, when a different administration comes in and they have to go find work elsewhere. Then they go and get huge salaries working for defense contractors or private think tanks and things of that sort. These people are highly ideological, and they've spent their careers advancing their own agenda or the agenda of their particular political party, their particular worldview. And you can't expect these people to serve you honestly and competently, you know, when you transition over. So President Trump, unfortunately, has partially authored his own situation. And you can see the appalling example of this, where even the National Security Council staff is untrustworthy. You know, his own staff, you know, there's only about 300 people on the NSC staff, 300 people out of 330 million Americans, all right?
Wow.
And being service on the NSC staff is after the president, you know, one of the most powerful positions in Washington, because you're so close to the White House and you have so much power over the interagency process and the rest. And it's also, and it doesn't stop. Even if a person serves only for like 6 months on the NSC staff, that is so impressive on their resume that they're basically set for life. You know, you can see even on Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, you know, there's these very young people, mostly from the Obama administration, you know, who served sometimes just briefly on the NSC staff, but sometimes they had longer service. But, you know, but they get jobs pulling in millions of dollars as television commentators and the like. So that's why when a president comes in, you know, one way of having his influence last beyond his own terms of office is have people who believe in you and support your policies in those NSC staff positions. You know, because those people, just by virtue of the fact that they've been on the NSC staff, you know, will end up having tremendous influence later on through their books, through the interviews, through the very high-ranking jobs they will hold in corporations. Oftentimes they're selected to be ambassadors and things like that. They're not necessarily the smartest people our country has produced either, because you're on the NSC staff.
You know, that being said,
that's unfortunate. There's a misconception you could just tell from the testimony of that ambassador to Ukraine, for example,
right,
or all three of them, you know, even though they have impressive sounding credentials. If you watch their testimony, if you could endure the whole thing, they're not the brightest bulbs, are they? You know? And indeed, you wonder, how can a person be occupying such a responsible position in the U.S. government and not understand the fundamentals of what our constitutional republic is about, that they serve at the pleasure of the president? The president can do no wrong. So what? I mean, even the Republicans who are defending President Trump, saying there was no quid pro quo, as if that's really important, okay? So what if there was a quid pro quo? It's the president's job to basically use our foreign aid money to get a quid pro quo out of these guys.
Right.
And it,
we don't just toss money.
Presidents
for,
in the past, including President Obama, been at all shy about using foreign aid money to advance, to do good, including for themselves politically and their party politically, as a leader of their party and their particular ideology that they want to advance. They're supposed to do that.
Well, so,
you know, there's nothing illegal at all about it, but people are so stupid, you know, even at that level. Well, maybe they do understand it, but they're hoping that the American people are the stupid
ones.
Well,
that's
the part. The American people don't know how it all works. Now, let me ask you this. He's been in office. The president's been in office now for 3 years. I'm sure he understands now the importance of people in those positions and possibly realizes he made a mistake keeping them on. Why can't he get them replaced and start getting a team together that actually supports what he wants to get done? Are we just lacking people that understand the issues where nobody else can possibly do it but the people that are already in there? Obama didn't have a problem putting all those people in there when he took office.
Yeah, and he fired tons of people.
He fired tons of them. Nobody yelled about that. And why can't Trump do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because my wife, Ruth, and I, we're just talking about this morning, and Ruth is, you know, very intelligent on these matters, and I tease her by saying that Donald Trump is her boyfriend, you know, because she is even more committed to the president than I am, and will defend him even against my criticisms, okay? But her explanation is that I think that this is valid, that, you know, when the president first came in, that, you know, you can think of the ship of state as like a big battleship, and it's been sailing in a particular direction for a long time. And a battleship is a very complicated mechanism. And so you want to change its course, but you can't turn the tiller to the hard right and make it change course, and at the same time replace all of the crew, you know, with people who have never had their hands on the levers of power before. You know, and so you want to sort of do it incrementally. And so that's an excuse, I think, for the first year or two of his, a legitimate excuse for the first year or two. But now I think, especially when it's so obvious that even after he's been 3 years in office and the intelligence community is still conducting basically a coup d'etat, some people want to take hard edges off of that word and call it a soft coup. Well, whether it's a soft coup or a classical
coup,
when you infiltrate people from the CIA onto the National Security Council staff, you know, who worked for Brennan and Biden, all right, you know, when these people are moles, basically, I mean, I think one would have to be fantastically naive to think that these people are just acting out of their own personal conscience.
Oh, no,
they're
actually the last of the great patriots in our country.
Yeah,
we have to,
that's the way they're.
Let's take a break because I got some comments on
that. That is the way that they are cast. And so now, of course, the Democrats have made the impeachment all about, you know, hurting everybody's feelings. But
I want to say something about that, but I guess you have to take a break.
Yeah, we'll,
right?
We'll do that right when we come back.
Yeah, hold that thought.
All right, you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I looked out this morning and the sun was gone. Turned on some music to start my day. And lost myself. Every night and every day now, never meaning what they say now, never saying what they mean.
while they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Oh, la da da.
A lot of games people play.
Yeah. Ivory Towers.
Okay, so Dr. Pry, can continue with that thought. We won't derail you.
Yes, like actually it was a thought of yours, Aaron, I wanted to build upon earlier when you had referred to the Ambassador Yovanovitch's giving us a history of Foreign Service officers and people associated with the State Department. People who've lost their lives, like the, you know, heroes of Benghazi, okay, who are tied to the intelligence community and all the rest, which fits in with this theme that you're talking about these people being American heroes and how dare President Trump, you know, overrule or say anything bad about these American heroes. And I thought that was just so appalling because, you know, this ambassador that's been fired from her job is going to be teaching at the University of Georgetown, you know, and she's never broken a fingernail on behalf of her country. On Laura Ingraham, the night after she so testified and compared herself to the heroes of Benghazi, for example, and that's what she was doing. You know, the whole reason for her peroration about these the sacrifices that have been made by people in our intelligence community and people in the Foreign Service was to associate herself, herself and her career with such heroes, which is totally inappropriate. You know, she hasn't done a thing along those lines. If anything, you know, she was betraying her country, you know, by bad-mouthing the President of the United States and resisting the foreign policies that he wanted to implement in Ukraine. And indeed, on Laura Ingraham that night, they had the mother of one of the heroes of Benghazi who had died, and she was. I rather wish Laura hadn't brought her on, because it was so heartrending to see her rendered almost speechless with frustration and anger that here her son was being held up as a hero, not to compliment her son, but protect the interests of the deep state. Of this deep state ambassador, when her experience, the State Department and the intelligence community wouldn't even talk to her, was
yeah.
completely uninterested in what happened to her son, and even casting aspersions on the heroes of Benghazi because they thought it could embarrass Hillary Clinton and interfere with her ambitions to become our next president. These people have no shame, and they are... Well, they have the perfect mindset because they have no shame. And this is just another example of being willing to do and say anything to get power and to win politically. It's very Machiavellian. It's exactly
oh,
the kind of mindset you get from totalitarian movements. And that's, in effect, what we've got, a totalitarian movement in the Democratic Party, which is mirrored also in the deep state, this administrative state, that supports the objectives of the Democratic Party, or at least supports having the deep state in control of everything. So our policy is supposed to be run, our core policy, out of places like the Department of State and, and the Department of Defense, by people who haven't been elected, many of them not even appointed by our own president, but are people who are holdovers from previous administrations or just permanent civil servants, part of permanent civil service bureaucracy. And we see this problem, this threat to our constitutional republic, not just in Ukraine, but in Turkey, which hopefully we'll have time to talk about later, on EMP protection, on building the wall, on immigration policy, you name it. You know, they have their own ideas on every topic about how it should be done. And their ideas are, well, it should be done the way we were doing it yesterday. And since President Trump is an anti-establishment change kind of guy, because American people, most of us, believe that we need change, that we can't keep going on and doing things the way things were done yesterday, that that's going to result in the destruction of our nation. That's why they're opposing him. You know, they are for business as usual. The only change they want is a change in the direction of increasing their power and their control over every aspect of American life, including our foreign and defense policy.
Right. Yeah, it's a change that they agree with. I mean, somebody else ran for office here not so awful long ago that ran on hope and change. And that was okay then, but now it, when we want to change it the other direction, all of a sudden...
Yeah, all of a sudden the bureaucrats have all
thing.
The answers.
And
how dare we criticize them or replace them?
Right. And
they have a right to those jobs.
I guess I'm really tired of hearing how these people...
Stunning.
Their opinion of what we should be doing, and that's where they're attacking Trump is because of these seasoned veterans, these seasoned
yeah, the career bureaucrats don't like what he's doing, so he has to be impeached, because that's impeachable now.
Yeah, and
yeah, that's right. The, you know, did the American people vote to go to get involved in a war with Russia?
Nope.
To protect Ukraine? I don't think they did. You know, I didn't hear President Trump running on that platform. I thought President Trump ran on a platform that our allies aren't doing enough to defend themselves. And Ukraine isn't actually an American ally, contrary to what they said. They used the phrase strategic partner because Ukraine is not a member of NATO even.
Right.
Well, besides that, Obama sent them nothing. I mean, he wouldn't even airdrop blankets into their country. He made them go fetch them from someplace else. So
Right. They
act like, oh my God, how could we not fall on our sword for these people that we've stood by and done so much for? I'm like, wait a second. For 8 years, we didn't do anything for them, and that was okay. Same career bureaucrats, right?
In fact, it goes back further than Obama. It goes back to the Clinton administration. You know, because at one time, Ukraine had been the third greatest nuclear power in the world. You know, when the Soviet Union broke up and Ukraine became independent, it had one or two strategic rocket forces missile armies located on its territory. So many nuclear weapons, advanced nuclear weapons, that it made it, after Russia and the United States, the third greatest nuclear power in the world, even greater than China and India, China, India, and Pakistan combined, did not have the kind of nuclear firepower that Ukraine alone enjoyed. And in order to get Ukraine to give up its nuclear weapons, and perhaps we shouldn't have asked them to do that, it might not have been a good idea. I mean, I don't think that Russia would have seized Crimea or started a war with Ukraine, all right, if they were a nuclear weapons state. Then it would be too dangerous for them. But Russia was very interested, too, in getting Ukraine to give up its nuclear arsenal. And Bill Clinton convinced them to do it in two ways, by promising that eventually they might be admitted to the European Union and might be admitted to NATO, but that in the interim, the United States and the United Kingdom, the Bucharest Agreement, guaranteed Ukrainian sovereignty and guaranteed to protect their borders. That was under the Clinton administration. And the Ukrainians, all the East European bloc countries, former Warsaw Pact countries, because in that heady time of heady optimism, you know, everybody thought that history had ended and the United States was and the Western democracies were for sure going to be the dominant forces far into the future. That was the way the future was going to go. They had such confidence in us and belief in the United States, and unfortunately they equated Bill Clinton with the United States, a man who is so dishonest he isn't even honest with his wife. But they put their fate in his hands and gave up those nuclear weapons. It wasn't long after that, you know, that Russia, well, by the Obama administration, Russia committed small minor acts of aggression against Georgia and under the Bush administration, but then went big, you know, by seizing Crimea and started this long war. I mean, Russia could roll over Ukraine and take the whole country over tomorrow, but it hasn't wanted to do that. You know, Russia knows that the intelligentsia in European NATO know about the Bucharest Agreement and all the security guarantees that were given a very high-profile way to Ukraine by both the United States and the United Kingdom, the two most powerful members of NATO, at least economically, most powerful. Turkey is actually, after the United States, the most powerful military member of NATO, but maybe we can talk about that later. So what Russia is doing is deliberately crucifying Ukraine in a very public way, year after year, so that the NATO member states and all the world can see that U.S. security guarantees aren't worth the paper they're written on. It would prefer to win without war by psychologically undermining, you know, the confidence of allies in the United States. And it also scaring our European allies, who are very pacifist, very reluctant to pull the trigger on anything, you know. But here Russia is clearly willing to engage in a protracted act of aggression, killing many thousands of people, and blooding its troops, by the way. I mean, for Russia, Ukraine is sort of a protracted military exercise. You know, we keep cycling its special forces and little green men in and out of there, and it's a gigantic training exercise that gets tens of thousands of their people, you know, trained on how to fight a war. That is invaluable, to have blooded veteran troops who've been in combat. You know, except for the United States, almost no, you know, European member of NATO has anything like the combat experience that Russia has given to its armed forces by using Ukraine as a punching bag.
Well, that's a kind of an interesting thing to consider. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we have him as our hostage for the second hour, so we won't be trying to wrap this up in 6 minutes in case you're freaking out. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever love someone so much you thought you lived?
I was born, six gun in my hand. Behind a gun, I make my final stand. Hey, it's why they call me.
So, Dr. Pry, why all of a sudden the, I don't know, just the new narrative? I think these guys, it's almost like in this impeachment thing, they're counting on the fact that nobody really knows what's in the Constitution. Nobody really understands what's been going on in foreign policy. No one has access to any history, and no one's going to go check.
Yes, they are counting on that. People who are well read in the Federalist Papers will know that you know, the provision for Congress to impeach a president almost didn't make it. There were many of the founders who were nervous about giving the Congress that power, precisely because they were afraid that if the country became polarized into various factions, you know, the way the Roman Republic did, that unscrupulous people would then be willing to use any tool, including impeachment, that impeachment could be used as a powerful weapon against a president, and that it could become commonplace to end up impeaching presidents. And I'm afraid that that's where we are going to go. You know, the Democrats have created a new standard that almost makes it necessary that regardless of suppose the Republicans lose the next election, you know, unfortunately, there's you have to fight fire with fire. And logically, if the Democrats succeed in creating this new tool, this new weapon, and using impeachment to bring down the Trump administration, if the Republicans are logical, they have to do the same thing against the Democrats. Now, unfortunately, the Republican Party is, and I say unfortunately only from a tactical point of view, the Republican Party historically has been so weak and doesn't go where Democrats go, which is one of the reasons our country has moved so far to the left. You know, because it's like playing a chess game against an adversary, and you have agreed that there are certain moves you will not make, giving them an inherent systemic advantage in the struggle that goes on. And that's why the Democrats have been so successful in advancing their agenda, and the Republicans so unsuccessful in advancing theirs. And tactically, it's necessary. Strategically, it's tragic. And the net effect, again, brings us down the road where we cease to be a constitutional republic, you know, because the Constitution isn't meant to be abused in that way, to be used for partisan political purposes. You know, the impeachment power is one of the greatest powers the Congress has, and, you know, it was provided only for very extreme conditions. I mean, the reason it was provided is because, you know, looking back at Roman history, there were people like Nero and Caligula, all right, that came up and somehow the Roman Senate was powerless to do anything against them. And impeachment was eventually provided, you know, for the possibility of such people coming to power. Bill Clinton is probably the closest we came to having a Caligula in charge. But people who committed, you know, gross violations of law and custom, not for political purposes, and that clearly is what this is. I don't believe the Democrats themselves believe the hogwash that they're trying to sell to the American people. It's all about politics, and it's all about grasping for power.
Well, it's embarrassing at this point. I mean, I don't know how they can sit up there and push this garbage that they're trying to make people believe when it's obviously not true. I know it.
Millions of people are believing it, and that's the danger. You know, they are doing it because they think it will pay off. That it'll pay off with their base. They have their flank is protected by the mainstream liberal media, and unfortunately, as you noted yourselves, most people don't read. I mean, 90% of our people are sort of politically illiterate about the Constitution, about our own history.
But even simple things like Adam Schiff saying that the fake whistleblower came to his office and all that stuff, I mean, that's all right there on tape, and then he goes bananas in the hearing and says that that's all a lie.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, there are all those college students, the Antifa types, all these college professors that teach them, that want us to be a socialist system. It's all lying in a good cause from their point of view.
Right.
Oh.
Because it doesn't matter if it's true or not. All that matters is advancing the so-called progressive agenda, which is basically the socialist agenda, which is basically the communist agenda. And, you know, that for them, the ends justifies the means. You know, these guys are acting the way their political base wants them to act. You know, they don't care about justice for Trump or fairness for the Republicans. From their point of view, anybody who voted for Trump or anybody who votes for the Republican Party is an enemy of the people, is on the wrong side of history, that we're Nazis. We're like Nazis, and we deserve whatever we get, including violence. That's where we are. That's why this is so dangerous. It's not just a breakdown in civility, as some people would have it. We've really, and I blame the Republicans for this because of their weakness. You know, the Republicans deserve a lot of blame for this, because they've let the Democrats get away with this,
right?
You know, for decades, and they've ignored cultural conservatives. They've allowed the religious and people of faith to be hounded out of the public square. They won't even defend President Trump's and Republican voters who are savagely assaulted on streets and can't speak at universities. They've allowed the universities to be taken over. They've sat back and allowed, you know, we've got judges that are clearly political and are rendering political judgments. And even a Republican-appointed justice, John Roberts, is living in a fantasy world that that once you become a justice, that political party and political affiliation and whoever appointed you doesn't matter, which is a complete lie. You know, the death of freedom comes from believing in lies like that and not facing facts. You know, and you know that's where we are.
Well, what really scares me is when this impeachment thing goes down in flames, and it will. There's just no way he'll get impeached. What are they capable of doing next? I mean, and you know, we've talked about, you know, when Trump gets a second term. I mean, their hair's going to catch on fire. They're going to go absolutely bonkers. And what are they capable of doing?
Well, I agree with you. You know, the left has this fantasy, and President Trump has joked about it, about the idea that he should have more than one term of office. But many of them on MSNBC and elsewhere have seriously commented that, you know, is Trump going to accept if he's defeated in the next election? Will he ever resign, or are we stuck with him? Now, we all know that's a fantasy.
Sure.
They also had a fantasy like that about Nixon, you know, that the left and the Democrats were afraid that Nixon would not leave office. There's an example. Now, Nixon wasn't impeached, okay, but there's an example of where the Republicans failed the American people. They should have stood by Nixon. You know, what he did was not really an impeachable offense. You know, he had loyalty to the Watergate burglars, and he didn't have any personal knowledge that was happening, you know. But the fact that the Republicans caved to the Democrats, you know, legitimized this as a political tool that they could use, and they've threatened to use it all along, and now they are using it, you know, against this president. And I wonder what's going to happen, you know, when the Inspector General Horowitz's report,
yes,
long-awaited report, the long-delayed report.
You know what? When we come back at the top of the next hour, we do need to tell people how the Inspector General reports work, because that's yet another thing that they're shading, counting on the fact that nobody really knows how that happens and how those reports are handled. So let's... Maybe we could start with that. We'll start with Horowitz the next hour. Our guest has been Dr. Peter Vincent Price. He'll be with us this next hour. We've got to take a quick break for the news and whatnot. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. We're actually airing live today, November 17th, 2019, just in case we replay this at a different time. You'll have some context for our discussion. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And who's our sponsor this hour, Bill Cundiff?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. If you're looking for a John Deere tractor or John Deere... turf equipment, go by and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in beautiful Shasta Lake City. And they've got a big inventory of tractors, implements, mowers, zero turns, you name it. They've got it in stock. Go by and talk to them. Also, they're a Honda dealer. They have a full line of Honda generators in stock. So power goes out, go by and see them. Or you can reach them on the phone at 226-9226 and online at papemachinery.com. So there you
go. And in the event of the impending power outage later on this week in Northern California, you might want to go give them a...
Yeah, get a generator before you need a generator.
Might want to check their generator stock, which is usually good, but don't wait till the power goes out. And also don't wait to go to the grocery store till the power's out. Pretty much take care of all that early. Oh, and fill up your gas tank. because otherwise the city of Reading gets really crowded because they don't shut the power off and all of a sudden the gas stations are overwhelmed. Yeah.
Californians have to be retrained now. We have a brand new program.
Got to do a survival and preparedness seminars out here. I got to tell you, we're not going to do well with that just based on history.
No.
Just based on events of the recent past.
Somebody needs to take care of me.
I had puppies die because my power went out. Oh, and I left them home in the dark and the cold while I went out to dinner. Huh. Definitely you should call, say, an elected official maybe and complain about that.
Yeah. Because they could fix it.
Member of the House. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. And so let me scroll back up here. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. We love having him on the show because he's full of information. And this is obviously a topic near and dear to his heart. He's written several articles, and I had trouble posting them a little bit, but I've got them on the site now. One was Pelosi's Illegitimate Impeachment Push and Our Vanishing Republic, and that's on there. He put that up on Newsmax September 25th of 2019. And then I think the other one we're going to veer into a little bit later is Clueless Democrats Don't Realize NATO Can't Lose Turkey. And that one... That was super recent. Can I see the date? Yes, October 16th. So those are all very current, very very pressing topics. But right before we went on the break, we were talking about the Inspector General's report that we've been hearing about for an eon. And I really think that most people hear Inspector General and they think there is only one for the entire federal government. And I'm not sure that
contraire.
And I don't think they realize, I don't think people really realize when those reports come out that it doesn't come out directly from him to the public, how it goes back through the agencies. So, Dr. Pry, maybe you could shed some light on how all that goes together so that we can all be smarter.
Sure. Well, let me say that Horowitz, I think if the report, if his Inspector General report, delivers what we're being told it will deliver, including recommended indictments. That will make Horowitz a very rare bird indeed, because he's not a Trump appointee; he's a holdover from the Obama administration. So there will have been one honest man, you know, who got through the Obama administration, and what, moreover, even rarer, you know, an honest man who is an inspector general.
Right.
You know, because the inspector general statute was passed during the Reagan administration, and it's one of the few times that I ever agreed with the Democrats, with the liberal Democrats. The idea was instituted by, introduced by a Carl Levin, who is a very liberal Democrat senator. And his idea was that the inspector general, there would be an inspector general for every major department and agency of the U.S. government. So the Department of Defense would have an inspector general, the intelligence CIA would have an inspector general, you know, the Justice Department would have an inspector general, there'd be an FBI inspector general, every major department and agency of the U.S. government would have a inspector general assigned to it to oversee it.
Now, are they independent of that agency?
Independent.
Okay.
And the office of the inspector general is supposed to be independent of that department or agency. Okay? You know, but Wallstetter, who was the, Weinberger, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, opposed that for the Department of Defense, saw it as a, and probably legitimately, you know, because, you know, he suspected that this was a liberal attempt to try to penetrate and undermine Reagan administration defense policy, and it probably was, let's face it, okay? And so he insisted that the Inspector General be incorporated so it would belong to the Department of Defense, and it would be funded through the Department of Defense, or if it was on the FBI, it wouldn't be independent of the FBI, but integral, organic part of the FBI, paid for, administered by the FBI, and tactically, you know, that was a good idea to protect the Reagan administration policy from you know, from Democrats, from, you know, who were probably created the Inspector General for the purpose of undermining Reagan administration policy. But strategically, taking the long view, it was, I think it was bad for the office, for the purpose of the Inspector General, and defeated the purpose of what the Inspector General is supposed to do.
Absolutely.
Because we've had the case of regulatory capture happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the Inspector Generals who belong to these various department agencies identify with them and have great loyalty to them. And I have had personal experience with this myself. And in fact, when I worked at the CIA, okay, I was very concerned with the left. There was even then, okay, it was the end toward the end of the Reagan administration. The left leaning attitude of the that affected intelligence analysis and tended to bury or ignore data, intelligence, which contradicted the narrative that the intelligence community was putting out, which was geared toward undermining the president's policy. And to cite just one example of that, I mean a really obvious example, because obviously I can't talk about classified intelligence, all right, but I thought it was appalling that, you know, when President Reagan was advancing the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was a brilliant idea, a way of rendering nuclear missiles obsolete, a way of giving the United States the upper hand in the Cold War. And indeed, even though we never deployed SDI, the threat of SDI, the Soviets themselves, many high-ranking Soviet officials and generals, have admitted that the mere threat of the coming on of the SDI, that defeated them in the Cold War. You know, looking down the road, they knew we were so technologically ahead of them in this area that they would not be able to compete, and that they had felt that had lost the Cold War at that point. So it was a brilliant idea, but not thought so by the particular office in which I worked at the CIA, because many analysts were clipping out cartoons that belittled President Reagan and the SDI program, and plastered them all over their doors and their walls. And I thought that this was intellectually unhealthy, you know?
Just a little.
To say the least. And so I went to the Inspector General, not just over that, but there were other more important issues as well that I brought to the Inspector General's attention. And it wasn't acted upon. And I found out years later, after I left the agency, and I was working with, I was on the House Armed Services Committee then, and I was assigned to Congressman Weldon, who was the, you know, vice chairman, he was the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee that writes the defense budget, and writes from which the intelligence budget is also paid. And Weldon was a fierce critic of the intelligence community, not an unreasonable critic by any means. I agreed with Kurt, you know, on a lot of the cover-ups that they were engaged in and acts of underestimating threats they were engaged in. Well, we were invited to meet with the director of Central Intelligence at the time, the CIA director at the time, John Deutsch, who glad-handed us and, you know, invited. Basically, we were having a little gathering. They were trying to butter Kurt up and butter me up as part of his staff. And there was a woman there who had been the Inspector General, who I had talked to, had brought, and she came up to me, and she couldn't resist. She couldn't refrain. She was still so angry. I didn't know it at the time. I had the impression that she was listening to me fairly and was actually going to take action on what I said. But she said, you know, I can't believe, you know, after all the agency did for you, that you came to me with that complaint, you know. And I told her that I couldn't believe that she had that attitude, because it was my impression that the Inspector General was supposed to welcome criticisms so that we would evade well, another Pearl Harbor, for example, right, in the nuclear missile age, and that it was their job to hear things like this, and so that the agency would not destroy its reputation by making catastrophic mistakes. And that little encounter taught me that these inspector generals are flypaper. For the most part, they're flypaper. You know, what they're really intended to do is weed out dissidents who don't support the company. So, that's
which,
right.
Which leads us right into how they do their report and, quote, whistleblowers. We've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. There's a lot to unpack in that whole thing, and we're not going to do it in 2 minutes, but that's how long we're going to celebrate capitalism. So we'll be right back after our little celebration of capitalism. You're listening to We the People. Reason I chose that song, because at the end of the day, the Inspector General's report winds up going to the agency that they are
investigating,
scrutinizing.
Right.
Then they work together on the report. Then the report's issued. So you don't see never see the raw data, and I don't think the public realizes. Like a great example of one that I actually worked on was with the VA down in Oakland. And I was getting phone calls from whistleblowers I was working with inside the VA. They were actual whistleblowers who actually saw real things and didn't file whistleblower protection because that just means they get fired. So they said, oh, my God, they found crack pipes in the bathroom today. And I'm like, whoa, that's not going to be good. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that in the report?
No.
No.
No, they worked it out.
Yeah, they worked it out. That didn't show up in there.
They just didn't realize they weren't supposed to bring
all the people who did bad
things.
Oh, none of that was in there. They found it all, but no one was held accountable, and the bottom line on the report was the same as every other inspector general report for the VA, which is they need more training, more supervision, and probably more money.
Exactly.
So is that the reason you never...
I don't think people realize there's collaboration, and this isn't some big...
But there's never any accountability that way. I mean, the people that do these egregious things are still there.
That's what we call it, government.
Oh, that's right. And not only are they still there, but they get promoted.
Right.
And then there's that.
You know, a sterling example of this is the 9/11 disaster. You know, killed 3,000 Americans dead. You know, one of the biggest intelligence failures in history. And nobody gets fired. Not only does nobody get fired, but the people most responsible for it in the intelligence community get promoted. And, you know, it'll really be... Now, hopes are being built up very high that the Horowitz report's going to rescue us.
Mm-hmm.
That just says so much about how weak the Republicans are in defending our constitutional republic. That the fate of our constitutional republic depends on Obama holdover inspector general doing the right thing again.
Right.
Can you imagine the pressure on that guy? You know, we've just talked about this, and he's got to, as Aaron pointed out, he's got to coordinate his report. I'm hoping that this guy will continue to be courageous and tell the truth. Whatever that report says, though, you can be sure that it's much worse than whatever that report says.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, because they take out all the real smoking gun high
points.
Well,
and maybe part of the saving grace of this report will be that a lot of the people that are no longer there will be in the report, and so it's not like you're going to have to fire somebody for wrongdoing because they're already gone.
Well, Brennan and people like that are gone at the very top level, all right? But for every Brennan, there's 10 or 100 people who he elevated, who bored their way into the system, into the bureaucracy, and they're still there. And these people are, you know, going to do everything they can to soften that report, to take the hard edges off the report. Now, I keep hearing from, you know, we keep hearing, you know, from Lou Dobbs and other Fox News shows and people who appear to have access are promising us that the report is going to be a good report and that indictments will come or be recommended. And I pray God that is true. But whatever, however good it is, it's still not going to be telling the whole truth.
No.
You know, in fact, most of the truth is probably going to be still covered up. And only the most egregious things will be disclosed. If that happens, we might all get a big surprise, and maybe the bad guys will succeed in turning Horowitz. And it won't be nearly as condemnatory as we're all hoping, and honest as we're all hoping. I find it, you know, very disappointing, to say the least, and very suspicious that the report, the much-promised report, that will soon be published. How long have we been hearing? Okay,
yeah.
It's coming out in the last year of the administration. You know, at a time when there's going to be a presidential election, we're going to be swinging into presidential politics, it'll be a time period when it will be hardest to act upon. If it does come out as a decent report and makes these recommendations, you know, it's always hard during the last year of an administration when you're trying to run for re-election to act on those recommendations. It gives a real good chance for the bad guys to get away scot-free, you know, especially if the president doesn't win re-election, you
sure.
know?
Yeah, then they're definitely...
And it certainly will give them an incentive. This is what I was trying to get to. If the Horowitz report is good and tells the truth and recommends indictments against guys like Brennan, what will they do? Are they going to stand by and just let that happen?
Nope.
You know, the mainstream media is always worried about a coup d'etat from the right, okay?
Yeah.
We already had an attempted coup d'etat from the left. If these guys have to face jail time, you know, they are, you know, former CIA directors, former FBI directors. They have connections that go deep into the system, and allies deep into the system that could be mobilized and create, well, a nightmare scenario.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the stuff you make scary movies out of.
You had talked about a couple of my articles. It was in the first article I wrote on this. Now, I'm trying to remember the title of it myself. 7 Days in May for Real. It was called 7 Days in May for Real. I published that a few years ago. It was when the story broke about the FBI counterintelligence investigation. So-called counterintelligence investigation, you know, that was aimed at President Trump, I tried to point out that, you know, there had been a movie made back was it the 60s? I think it was the 60s, called 7 Days in May.
Oh yeah,
that postulated a coup against a liberal American president who, over a foreign policy issue, you know, who wanted a nuclear disarmament treaty with the Soviet Union and an American general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, decided to orchestrate a coup d'etat to save the country from this idiotic foreign policy that the liberal American president wanted to perform. And I just thought it incredibly... And this was written with a serious purpose. It wasn't just by the Hollywood movie was written and produced. And Kirk Douglas had been a socialist, and he was a left-wing activist. He was one of the heroes in this thing. They actually had real people in mind. They thought that Ernest LeMay, who had been the commander of the Strategic Air Command at the time, that he was capable of mounting a coup against President Kennedy, and that's what 7 days in May was supposed to have been, you know, what was been about, even though it might have been made after the Kennedy administration. You know, at the time it was conceived and the screenplay written, that's the scenario they had in mind. So how ironic, you know, decades later, and after Nixon and everything, I mean, we periodically hear from the left all the time about the threat that the right supposedly poses to our constitutional republic.
Oh, yeah.
But when it comes right down to it, they're the ones. They're the ones, you know, that are threatening our constitutional republic, have all actually already destroyed it, you know, just by mounting this illegal and unconstitutional impeachment inquiry for political purposes. They've shredded the Constitution by what they're doing right now every day on TV.
Well, and
the question is, can we get our constitutional republic back?
Right.
Well, also, you got to look at future presidents are going to look at what's going on with the intelligence community today. And do they dare go against them in the future? I mean, you talk about intimidating. Look at what they're capable of doing. I think, you know, they want to talk about intimidating a witness and blah, blah, blah. I think the intelligence community is very intimidating at this point to any future president that wants to go against their wishes.
Sure. The whole apparatus of the state, in addition to the intelligence community, you take something like the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we already played footsie
look what
with
happened.
Them.
There's never, and this is another thing where I damn the Republicans for failing in their job. You know, here we've had President Trump for 3 years, and the Democrats got away, you know, with the IRS scandal, you know, where they basically used the powers of the IRS to destroy hundreds of conservative nonprofits. President Obama might not have gotten that second term, you know, if the IRS hadn't done that, because that's what conservatives, you know, the left had been using the 501c3 provision in the IRS code to establish nonprofits that were basically activist groups for
right.
left-wing political purposes, and doing that for decades successfully, okay?
Sure, and look at how successful
then,
the environmental groups are.
It took a long time to figure out, gee, we could be doing that too. And then when we tried to do it, you know, the Obama administration wouldn't let it happen. And they got away with it.
Yeah, I know our group here in Reading kind of had our legs cut out from under us, but, you know, they continued to fight it. It was just, again, there seems to be no equal application of justice under the system. We have to take a really
right.
quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I cannot believe we have already blown through most of the show. Unbelievable. Great information today. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good.
When we get our secret hardcore right wing enclave, that's going to be our theme song.
Yeah,
we're going to put it in like Wyoming or somewhere where no one will think to look for us. and we're gonna celebrate truth and justice and I don't know, go to Galt's Gulch, I guess.
Yeah,
I always loved that song.
I do too.
I wonder if we could talk about Turkey before we
oh
before
sure
we lose all of our time.
Yeah, we are. We're gonna run out of time.
Okay, but actually, it does fit in to the larger theme of what we're talking about how the president is responsible for setting our foreign policy. And this is just another example, an actually bigger and more important example than Ukraine, of the struggle for who's in charge of our government and our policies. Is it the deep state or is it the president of the United States? Because there's much at stake here in President, and I call it, say, Turkey, but it's basically President Trump's Syria policy. And I wrote an article that was published much more recently. I think it was on November 5th. I had to actually publish it in Canada by the McKenzie Institute because I couldn't get it published, even in conservative journals here in the United States, because it supported President Trump on his Syrian policy. And even many conservatives are attacking President Trump for withdrawing those 1,000 troops from Syria. And from and also since President Trump just recently met with Erdogan,
yeah.
Yeah, it's perhaps appropriate that we should say something, you know, about this issue. And the title of my article was American Empire or America First? ? And basically talks about what I call the Trump Doctrine. And President Trump himself has not declared a foreign policy doctrine, but there is one that he ran on. And in effect, what I think it amounts to is, you know, President Trump, contrary to his critics, is not an isolationist. He's not trying to go back. When he says America First, he's not talking about, you know, the 1930s and 1940s American firsters who wanted America to go into an isolationist crouch and not get involved anywhere in the world. President Trump does want to maintain our alliance relationships, but they've got to be true alliances where our alliance partners carry their fair share of the defense burden, so that it really isn't an imperial system where America is carrying nearly 100% of the costs and sacrifices to defend so-called alliances. You know, that's not an alliance system. That's an imperial system where we have where America has unwillingly, you know, become the owner of an enormous empire. You know, we have over 100 American troops are in over 150 countries worldwide, mostly engaged in continuing the forever war against terrorism. And so part of the America First policy is to make sure our allies carry their fair share, and also to end the endless forever war on terrorism and shift it really to away from where it has, instead of the United States having to carry that. That's an example of the kind of thing that involves localized conflicts or regional conflicts that our allies should be engaged in. And it shouldn't necessarily be done with military force. It's really, intelligence agencies like the CIA are far better suited for that. You know, the Department of Defense tends to use these sledgehammer tactics, you know, the launching a cruise missile into wedding parties, that tends to, so they can get a terrorist leader, but then they kill the bride, and it tends to create more terrorists than it kills. You know, you need to be targeted, you know, very limited. Britain and Russia are good examples. In the 19th century, they managed to protect their interests and advance their interests in the Middle East and Central Asia with just a handful of area specialists who had money to spread around, who had guns to spread around, who knew the languages and knew the tribes, and got them to do the biddings of their particular governments. If they did nothing else, they could stir up trouble and have them picnicking on each other instead of being a threat to British and Russian interests. And that's up until, you know, the global war on terrorism. That's how we were conducting the policy before 9/11. And had Bill Clinton not been a coward and done his job, we wouldn't have had a 9/11 and had a global war on terrorism. It's right in the 9/11 Commission reports, you know, where you can read that the agency gave Bill Clinton, you know, three opportunities to liquidate Osama bin Laden. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't pull the trigger on any of them. And 3,000 Americans paid the price for that. But coming back, so that's another part of the Trump Doctrine, you know, having, marshaling our forces and being smarter in the use of our forces so that instead of having the Pentagon chiefly responsible for conducting something like a global war on terrorism, that's done by our allies and it's done by their intelligence services in cooperation with our intelligence services, so that our military, with our limited economic resources, because America, you know, even though we're still the wealthiest nation in the world, the percentage of wealth that we control is nothing like it was in the aftermath of World War II, you know, when we controlled something like 50% of world gross domestic product. You know, now we control a much smaller percentage of the pie. And so we can't do everything. The Pentagon always wants to do everything. What we need to do is the big job, which is play the balance of power politics and have conventional and nuclear forces that are sufficiently strong so that we can deter Russia or China or North Korea or Iran from starting a World War III, or if they do start it, that we can win it. We can't do everything and do that. That's the biggest, most important job for the United States, and it's what we should be doing. Afghanistan alone was costing us $50 billion a year, you know? And as I said, we're in 150 nations. So this thing has been a real impediment to serving this role. And this is, I call it the Trump Doctrine, but really, that was basically what the United States was doing throughout most of the Cold War until we got involved in the global war on terrorism. So it's a kind of ironic that what President Trump is trying to do is go back to the policies of Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, minus the Vietnam War, okay? But we have a new business-as-usual thing that we've been doing, which is the global war on terrorism. And that's why the establishment doesn't want them to pull 1,000 troops out of Turkey. And I thought this was a good test. This was an interesting test for President Trump to begin his policy of withdrawing American troops from places that they don't belong anymore so that we can husband our forces for the big one, to deter the big one or win the big one if it comes along. 1,000 troops, and their mission had already been accomplished. You know, we basically destroyed ISIS, destroyed the caliphate. There was mopping up to do, but that could be done by Turk and the Syrians and the Russians. And those troops were at great risk. You know, 1,000 troops surrounded by hundreds of thousands of hostile forces, Russian, Syrian, and Iranian, and terrorist hostile forces. It was a catastrophe waiting to happen. But the Department of Defense and the State Department were adamantly opposed. His own Secretary of Defense, opposed, Mad Dog Mattis opposed us pulling those troops out of Syria. You know, so this here again, you've got a case of the permanent bureaucracy, including Trump's own appointees, you know, opposing the new policy that the United States, that President Trump wanted us to pursue. And it's a smart policy. It's a policy the United States should be pursuing. And in part and parcel of this attempt to undermine the Trump policy was romanticizing the Kurds. How can we abandon the Kurds? You know, yeah. The Kurds did so much to take out ISIS. We owe the Kurds so much. Well, that gets it absolutely backwards. You know, the Kurds weren't doing us any favors. ISIS was their mortal enemy. They had to fight ISIS, or ISIS was going to destroy them. We're the ones that saved the Kurds in the first place by helping them, supporting them in the war against ISIS. And we had temporary interests in common with the Kurds. But we don't have the kind of long-term interests in common with the Kurds that we do with Turkey. Basically, you've actually had people on the left and the right in Washington calling for expelling Turkey from NATO and in favor of the Kurds. And this is an example, again, strange situation, where Trump is accused of disrupting business as usual, you know, in his Syrian policy. But what he's really doing is remembering older and wiser statesmen's policies toward that region of the world and trying to reinstate those policies, because Turkey is far more important to long-term U.S. national security interests than the Kurds. You know, basically, the NATO alliance.
I can hear the Democrats screaming, blasphemer!
Yes, right. I mean, the NATO alliance is indefensible without Turkey. You know, not only is Turkey, after the United States, the strongest military member of NATO, it has more tanks, it has more planes, more troops than any other member of NATO, including Britain and France and Germany. So it's the strongest military member of NATO. It's geographically, it's got this incredibly important geographic location where it's close to the Middle East, you know, right next door to Syria, near Lebanon and Israel, this vitally important crossroads of the world that since biblical times has decided the fate of empires, okay? And it controls the Marmara Sea and the Dardanelles and the Bosporus so that it can keep the powerful Russian Black Sea fleet bottled up in the Black Sea. It also is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. It's got 100 air bases, airports that could be used to support air operations over the Balkans, over the Black Sea, over the Middle East. Now, right now we're in a tug of war. Hold that thought.
We better take a quick break because we're headed for the top of the hour and want to give you enough time to sum up the entire world policy and the impeachment in the last few minutes. No pressure.
I will endeavor to do so.
Oh, okay, cool. You'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
It's a party in the CIA. Need a country to stabilize. Look no further, we're your guide. We're your guide. We've got snazzy suits and ties. Suits and ties. And a better day. Brainwashing moles like it. We only torture the folks we don't like. You're probably gonna be okay.
You're gonna be okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Yeah, yeah. It's a party in the CIA.
Too many lives they spent across the ocean. Too much money.
Well said. So, you know, heading into this next week, are do you think any of this is going to have anything to do with policy and all that, or is this just going to be another dog show with a bunch of people trying to make the president look like a bad guy and no substance?
Oh, you've already lost interest in Turkey? I guess that was
no. I just wondered
not as
because
interesting as I hope your audience would find it.
No,
but let
it,
me wrap
it
up
is,
the Turkey
but,
thing, okay?
Turkey,
and then I'll answer that question.
Yeah, because Turkey
the
is the point.
The bottom line is, you know, we are in a tug of war with Russia over Turkey.
Right.
Russia might be able to flip Turkey and pull them into their orbit. If that happens, NATO is indefensible because the Russian Black Sea fleet can get out into the Mediterranean. And then Turkey becomes an unsinkable aircraft carrier for Russia.
For Russia.
Yeah.
And a Turkey hostile to us. And if you just think about where Turkey's located relative to the Mediterranean Sea, I mean, the whole southern flank of NATO is suddenly ripped wide open. And you cannot defend NATO under those circumstances. So we cannot afford to lose Turkey. And we may well lose Turkey. You know,
well, didn't Russia just supply them with a bunch of missiles?
Pardon me? Yeah, Russia is supplying them with air defense missiles. That's
right.
One of the points that the deep state doesn't want us to sell F-35s to Turkey if they're going to buy Russian missiles.
Right.
And so, you know, if we cancel the F-35 sales, that further brings Turkey into Russia's orbit. And and Erdogan, he's not a nice guy. He's an Islamist. He's an authoritarian personality. And it was predicted decades ago by an excellent book, you know, that Clash of Civilizations, you know, that Turkey would rediscover its Islamist roots and eventually leave NATO. And it might be happening now, and it might be historically inevitable. But we shouldn't be pushing them out of NATO and into Russia's arms. We should be doing everything we can to try to keep them in NATO. Otherwise, it would be a catastrophe for us. And President Trump seems to be the only one in Washington who understands that. And you know, these deep state guys who have forgotten the Cold War, but they remember the global war on terrorism and therefore are, you know, have a love affair with the Kurds, you know, they're the ones who are actually wanting us to stick with yesterday's business, which was the global war on terrorism, whereas tomorrow's business is the new Cold War with Russia and with China, but with Russia, Turkey matters immensely. So I'll conclude my remarks on that. And that's why, but it's just an example of one of the most important foreign policy differences between President Trump and the deep state that's going on right now, where, again, President Trump is, well, not only is he right, but he's, even if he was wrong, his policy is the one that should be followed because he's the president. Now, to answer your questions, what do I anticipate in terms of the future of the impeachment inquiry? You know, I think it's going to be more of the dog and pony show,
Okay. Except
they gave it their best shot. Those witnesses, I understand, that they had, you know, the State Department people were their best, and they gave it their best shot. So it's actually going to be the kinds of witnesses they bring on, unless Schiff is smart enough to hold back some kind of a huge surprise that nobody's anticipated. I think they're going to be less and less impressive witnesses with even less relevant testimony to provide.
Because all this information, I guess I wasn't I wasn't trying to derail you from Turkey. What I was actually wondering is, do you think anybody in this process is ever going to bring up any of that? Because that's all part of it, and that's why some of these decisions were made. You know, conditional aid and that sort of thing. I just don't see any of that being brought forward. They're still telling the public that they're not allowed to do that, that the career bureaucrats are the ones who have all the knowledge, make all the decisions, and should be calling all the shots.
Well, Representative Jordan, you know, for example, a number of the...
He's been doing a pretty good job.
They've been doing an excellent job pointing out that it's the president's job to set foreign policy, and they've made that point over and over again. In the context of Ukraine, I have to, again, fault the Republicans here for the way they decided to handle this. In one of the articles that you cited, Our Vanishing Republic, I made a number of recommendations of what the Republicans should do. And one of the things I think that they should do was not participate, not even participate, you know, because by their mere presence, even though they're taking a role of defending President Trump, it lends legitimacy to a process that's unconstitutional and illegal. You know, the charges, alleged, put quotes around that of charges, what they are trying to call charges, you know, the idea that the president is trying to use foreign aid money to influence Ukrainian policy, there's nothing illegal about that.
No, that's what actually he's supposed to be doing.
Every president does it. The Republicans should be, they should be so opposed to the idea of bringing of an impeachment inquiry that they should refuse to participate in it, to end an air of legitimacy to it. And they should be holding press conferences every day saying, you know, this is an example of the Democrats behaving like a totalitarian party, that it's all a sham, it's all a political thing. They should be holding their own hearings. They should be withholding recognition from Nancy Pelosi and from Schiff as legitimate chairman, because they've shredded the Constitution in a very obvious way through this impeachment, and they've given up the right to be regarded legitimately as leaders of the House on the Democrat side, and the Republicans could and should be holding their own hearings on this, where they send out subpoenas, you know, to bring in Biden and his son and Hillary. And do embarrassing things to the Democrats. They could even pass bills from the Republican caucus and send them to the Senate. Now, of course, all of this too is just political theater. But that's what the Democrats are doing too. It's political theater for a political political purpose, and the Republicans need to fight fire with fire. So I think that they're not fighting back hard enough or smart enough, even though they are making smart points in the hearings and on Fox News and the rest. The simple fact that they're there every day lends legitimacy to proceedings which are not legitimate.
Well, I think by by not being there, I think it'd be, wouldn't it be even more damaging? I mean, you kind of have to be there or else you're conspicuously...
Do you think the public would get it? I mean,
I think that they would. You know, if the Republicans held press conferences to explain why they're not there. And impeachment is supposed to be a bipartisan process, you know? And, you know, and I think that their absence would speak volumes. It would speak volumes to the people that that this was purely a Democrat thing and not a Republican thing. And I know the argument that you just made that, well, isn't that abandoning the floor to them and giving them, you know, and that's a legitimate argument. And that's basically the winning argument. That's why the Republicans are there, because they don't want to just give Adam Schiff free rein.
Yeah,
but I would argue that on balance, it does more damage to our case to lend legitimacy to this illegitimate, unconstitutional process by participating in it.
That's a cool idea. I like that. I hope people will go on and read your articles. We are out of time, but I've linked all sorts of good stuff for you during the show, so you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here on November 17th, 2019, with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pride. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
Catch everyone again next week.